Maureen Anu Kelly was born on September 26th of 1993 and was raised by a single mother named Mapuana in Spokane, Washington. Following her graduation from Lewis and Clark High School, she listed her occupation on Facebook as guru, that's spreading the love, but told friends she aspired to become a singer-songwriter. Owing to her heritage as a Pacific Islander, Maureen's instrument of choice was the ukulele, and she often posted videos of intimate bedroom performances on the video streaming site YouTube. Maureen's half-sister, Jerry Kapu, later described her as a very laid-back, carefree girl, and mentioned how in June of 2013, 19-year-old Maureen had called her to request a favor. She called me before she left, saying she was going camping with friends and asked if she could borrow some of my camping gear, Sherry said. She was excited about going and told me she loved me. And that was totally normal for her. She was a very affectionate person. The next day, Maureen stopped by Sherry's apartment to collect the camping gear. When Sherry asked where she was headed, Maureen replied that she and her friends planned to visit the Gifford Pinchot National Forest. The reply surprised Sherry. Maureen was very much an admirer of Mother Nature, but she was not an experienced camper. She had previously expressed a desire to spend a prolonged period living outdoors, but had never been suited to the realities of wilderness living. I asked her, "Why now?" Sherry later said, and Maureen told me that she wanted to go on a spiritual quest, and that really concerned me. As she departed, Sherry waved Maureen off after wishing her the very best of luck, but little did she know, it was the last time they'd ever see each other. Located around 3 hours' drive southeast of Seattle, the Gifford Pinchot National Forest extends more than 70 miles along the western slopes of the Cascade Mountain Range, from Mount Rainier in the west to the Columbia River in the east. The forest consists of broad, old-growth woodland and high mountain meadows, along with several glaciers and numerous volcanic peaks. The forest also features the Canyon Creek Campground, a small, lightly used camp tucked in the forest adjacent to the eponymous body of water. 8 campsites are available for tent camping only and come complete with a small dining table and a fire ring for warmth and cooking. To get there, Maureen and her friends drove out to Chelachi near Highway 503 on June 9th of 2013. From there, they traveled east on Road 54, then turned down a series of small back roads until they reached Canyon Creek. They found the campsite, along with the trail that led to it, completely unmaintained, but Maureen's companions were experienced campers and set about making the area much more comfortable for themselves. The group set about clearing away all the fallen pine needles from the camp stove and table, then, after setting up their tents for the evening, they enjoyed a small campfire dinner. Yet following their meal, the group noticed that Maureen's behavior took a turn for the bizarre. Her fellow campers were well aware of her desire to embark on some kind of spiritual journey, but had no idea what that entailed. So when Maureen approached her tent and began to strip, completely naked, her companions were nothing short of flabbergasted. By the time she was ready to begin her spiritual journey, Maureen was barefoot and wearing nothing but a small fanny pack containing a knife, some matches, and a compass. Her friends advised her against heading out into the woods in such a state of undress, but the 19-year-old insisted. She reassured her companions that she wouldn't walk too far and would be back by midnight at the very least, as well as insisting that her state of undress was essential to the completion of the aforementioned journey. And so, with trepidation, Maureen's friends watched her disappear among the trees, and never to be seen again. When midnight came and went, and Maureen failed to reappear, her friends began to panic. They fanned out into the darkness of the woods, flashlights in hand, and called out to their missing companion, but there was no reply to be heard. Unable to rest while Maureen remained unaccounted for, her friends contacted the local sheriff's department to report her missing. Around an hour later, the first deputies arrived at the campground to begin their investigation. Skamania County Undersheriff Dave Cox later recalled this interaction with unease. Maureen's friends told us that she talked about doing this spiritual quest thing for quite some time, he said. Apparently, she felt it was something she needed to do. Cox said his deputies told the teenagers to be brutally honest with them before asking if Maureen had been under the influence of drugs or alcohol at the time of her disappearance. Each vehemently denied any kind of drug or alcohol use, and according to Dave Cox, their position seemed more than plausible. They could have quite easily tidied up the campsite prior to the deputy's appearance, but upon their arrival, the teenagers seemed alert and focused, with deputies observing no evidence of drug or alcohol consumption at the campsite. Within just a few short hours, Undersheriff Cox was helping orchestrate one of the largest search and rescue efforts Skamania County had ever seen. But right away, the prognosis was grim. The area that Maureen had ventured into, almost completely nude, with nightfall rapidly approaching, is one of the steepest and most hazardous in the entire region. Sharon Ward, a representative of the Pacific Crest Search Dogs Association, personally participated in the search and rescue effort. The area Maureen walked off into is amazingly steep. It's called Canyon Creek for a reason, Sharon said. How she got down there is a mystery, but then climbing up again in her bare feet, that had to be tough going. It's a remote area, lots of timber and brush, so her feet would have been cut up by the time she made it up to the other side. And she did make it up there, we're in no doubt of that. A total of 75 professional and volunteer rescue workers combed the woods around Canyon Creek for 5 whole days. They did so in shifts, employing a multitude of search and rescue techniques over an area of 4 square miles. But by far the most effective asset at their disposal was the team of dedicated tracker dogs. After honing in on Maureen's scent, the dogs traversed the entirety of Canyon Creek, then headed north into the woods towards a pathway known as Forest Road No. 54. Expert trackers followed close behind and quickly detected a series of human footprints in the soft dirt. Investigators were in no doubt that these belonged to Maureen, but after following them north towards the service road, the footprints suddenly and inexplicably disappeared. Investigators then looked to the tracker dogs to continue marking out the trail, but they simply wandered among the trees for a while before returning to follow the scent trail in reverse. For those present, it must have made for an extremely chilling moment. For all intent and purpose, they were standing in the place where Maureen Kelly had simply ceased to exist. It was a truly baffling turn of events, but the search teams followed standard operating procedure and spent the next 4 days using Maureen's last known location as the focal point for their operation. Rescue workers combed the area around Road No. 54, carefully searching for any new tracks or scent trails, but as the days went by, the weather grew worse and worse. Thick cloud cover prevented helicopter teams from circling the area, while heavy rain impeded the ground team's ability to conduct a proper search. A person could literally walk right on top of somebody and never know it, one volunteer later said. Then if they were rolled over a log or something, forget about it, we'd have to dig up the whole forest to find them. By June 15th, just less than a week after she'd initially disappeared, Maureen's loved ones began to consider the possibility that the search teams were no longer looking for a live person. Despite the weather on the day of her disappearance being relatively mild, nighttime temperatures would have quite possibly dipped into the 40s. Then, coupled with some light rain, Maureen could have found herself developing hypothermia at an alarming and unexpected rate. This theory became increasingly popular following the rescue effort's conclusion, which came at 6 p.m., on June 15th of 2013. Skamania County Sheriff personally promised Maureen's mother that the investigation would continue and that no matter how tragic her daughter's end, her remains would be brought home. Professionals and volunteers alike continued the search area surrounding Service Road 54, albeit on a much slower and ad hoc basis. But as the months went by, something very chilling became evident. Given that the prevailing theory was that Maureen had fallen victim to the elements, It stood reason that it was only a matter of time before her body, or what remained of it, was recovered. Yet time after time, both professional and amateur search teams headed out into the woods and came back empty-handed. Some posited that Maureen's remains had been set upon by hungry scavengers, and that they could now be spread out over a much wider area. But if that were the case, surely one of the many search and rescue teams would have reported such a discovery. Not even an animal bone was isolated and analyzed as possibly belonging to Maureen, which leads us to believe that her fate may well have been very different from those suggested by search and rescue experts. Last June marked the 10-year anniversary of Maureen's mysterious disappearance, and as frustrating as it is, an entire decade has brought us no closer to understanding what truly happened to her. Yet perhaps the best insight into her ultimate fate can be found in a Facebook status that she posted on June 6th of 2013, just 3 days before she wandered off into the woods with not a stitch of clothing on her. "Happiness," she wrote, "is something that cannot be found." The Reverend Maurice Dometz was born in Blue Rapids, Kansas on June 24th of 1896. After graduating high school, Maurice briefly attended Hastings College up in Nebraska, but dropped out just months before his final examinations in favor of studying at Omaha's Presbyterian Theological Seminary. He then attained a master's degree in theology from the University of Denver before continuing his academic study at the city's Rockman College. From 1923 to 1943, Maurice earned a living as the associate editor of the Christian monthly magazine, Grace and Truth, and it was during this period that he met his wife-to-be, Myrtle. They were married on June 1st of 1930, settled in Longmont, Colorado, and soon welcomed a daughter named Martha Ann into the world. Throughout his life, Maurice continued work as the editor of various Christian magazines, to which he often contributed, as well as serving as the Longmont Chamber of Commerce, the Denver Bible College Board of Trustees, and the Rockmont College Alumni Association. Maurice also had many passions in life, but perhaps the most eccentric of them all was his passion for what he referred to as his beloved rocks. It was an affectionate nickname, as in truth, Maurice possessed a fascination for rare minerals and gemstones. He was a keen member and avid contributor to the American Federation of Mineral Societies, while holding a senior position at the Flatirons Gem and Mineral Club. And throughout his life, he regularly engaged in one of his favorite hobbies, mineral hunting. Even in his advanced years, Maurice would enlist the help of a more mobile friend, then drive out into the woods to hunt for rare quartz or hematite. And that's exactly what he was doing on April 29th of 1981, when he and a man named David McSherry traveled to the Topaz Point picnic area near Devil's Head, Colorado. Topaz Point, named for the high quantities of the eponymous mineral present in the surrounding rock formations, is located in Colorado's Pike National Forest. Stretching west of Colorado Springs, the forest encompasses over 1 million acres and is spread out over several of the surrounding counties. Splitting the forest in two is a 45-mile-long unpaved track named Rampart Range Road, which has magnificent views of Pike's Peak, the surrounding prairie, and the rugged Tarryall Mountains. The forest is popular with campers and mountain bikers and boasts Colorado's only functioning fire lookout tower, which sits atop of Devil's Head. On the day in question, Maurice was wearing a white baseball cap, a maroon plaid flannel shirt, and brown ankle-high work boots. Once they had found a suitable parking spot, David helped the 84-year-old Maurice to reach their digging spot, a small sandy pit not far from the Rampart Range Road. He and David had spent a short while digging through the sand pit before Maurice suggested his much more mobile companion begin another trench around 50 to 60 yards away. A few hours went by with each man burrowing away at their respective dig sites. Then, around 3 p.m., David walked over to Maurice's trench to let him know that it was time to drive home. He agreed, Then, when David returned from his dig site after collecting his tools, Maurice was gone. Since the Reverend's own tools were nowhere to be seen, David assumed that he'd simply packed them away, then walked uphill to meet him at their car. There were no signs of a struggle at Maurice's dig site, meaning David had no reason to be alarmed. But when he too trudged up the hill and his car became visible at the crest, the Reverend Dometz was nowhere to be seen. David honked his horn a few times, hoping it would summon the elderly Reverend to their vehicle, yet he remained out of sight and failed to respond to any of David's cries. David then walked in circles around the place that they were parked, hoping his elderly companion might be taking a pre-ride pee against a tree trunk, but became increasingly panicked when Maurice was nowhere to be found. It wasn't so much the man's absence which frightened David. Despite his age, Maurice was a fit and capable individual, and wasn't imperiled by simply being outdoors. What frightened him was that Maurice had seemed to suddenly, and quite inexplicably, disappear. And by 11 p.m. that night, the Douglas County Sheriff's Department had its dedicated search and rescue team on the scene, who conducted preliminary oversight searches before daylight could aid their primary effort. In total, just shy of 100 people descended on the area surrounding Topaz Point to lend a hand in the search. Human chains made up of volunteers walked slowly through the trees, eyes glued to the earth, while teams of dedicated tracker dogs ran roughshod through the hills, trying in vain to locate any kind of scent trail. Many involved expressed incredible frustration at their inability to locate any trace of their missing person. At the very minimum, the tracker dogs should have at least given them an idea of which direction Maurice went, yet they only ever seemed to alert at the trench that he'd been digging at. It was almost as if he and his digging equipment had simply vanished into thin air. Despite their failure to achieve any meaningful progress, the search continued for around 2 to 3 weeks before it was finally discontinued. Maurice's wife, Myrtle Dometz, expressed tearful indignation at the decision and accused the Colorado governor of abandoning her husband. In an open letter, she publicly begged him for help and insisted the case was much more sinister than that of a regular missing person. Many believed Myrtle's claims were nothing but manifestations of her inconsolable grief, but others, volunteer searchers included, voiced their agreement. Many claimed that in their experience, Maurice's disappearance had to involve some kind of foul play. The fact that the tracker dogs were unable to pick up his scent suggested that Maurice had been transported out of the area by vehicle, and quite possibly against his will. Nothing else could explain why the tracker dogs couldn't find a trail. Nothing natural, anyway. Finally, in the year 1990, the Reverend Maurice Dometz was officially declared deceased in absentia by a Colorado Supreme Court judge after being missing for a total of 9 years. Relatives petitioned the judge to have Maurice's death declared unlawful, which would have in turn forced police to reopen the investigation into his disappearance. But since there were no signs of any struggle at the Topaz Point dig sites, and since there had been no blood or cries or help suggesting some kind of attack of abduction, the judge refused the family's request and refused a verdict of unlawful death in favor of one by misadventure. Since then, a number of prevailing theories have emerged, each of which attempt to explain Maurice Dometz's sudden and rather chilling disappearance. The first, and perhaps the most feasible, is that Maurice suffered severe complications due to the blood disorder he'd been suffering from for many years. Others say he could have quite possibly taken his own life, having considered it a less painful, less drawn-out alternative to dying in a hospice bed. It would have been just like Maurice, they say affectionately, to want to spend his final day digging for those beloved rocks of his, rather than face a time when he'd be unable to do so. Yet to the contrary, Dometz was a lifelong man of God, who tried to weave the Bible's teachings into every one of his conscious acts. Therefore, it seems highly unlikely that he'd opt to take his own life over a natural, God-given end to his life. On the more ridiculous end of the theory scale, some have suggested that David McSherry murdered his friend Maurice in order to secure a huge stash of topaz for himself. but the man has been questioned extensively and has never once been considered a legitimate suspect. And so, what else might explain a man's sudden and rather chilling disappearance? Did David McSherry murder his elderly companion out of malice, or did he assist in the voluntary end of a sick man's life? Or perhaps, something far more sinister, but far less explainable, is to blame. On July 25th of 1981, 14-year-old Stacy Aris of Saratoga, California, accompanied her father and a party of seven others on a horse riding trip in the Sunrise Meadows region of Yosemite National Park. After trotting for a few hours among the serene, snaking streams of violet-tinted lavender fields, the group decided to take a break at a site known as Sunrise High Sierra Camp. The camp is around 3 miles southeast of Tenaya Lake and includes sleeping and washing areas. So rather than plow on through the high heat until sunset obscured their path, the group decided to bed down at the campground and then set off again in the morning. After arriving at the cabins, Stacy took a shower and changed her clothes. Then, when she emerged from the washrooms, she spotted an older man named Gerald Stewart sitting on a rock around 30 meters away from the cabins. Gerald's perch looked out over a beautiful alpine meadow, which in turn was backdropped by the snow-capped twin peaks of Mount Florence and Mount Clark. When Stacy spotted the vista, she grabbed her camera and told her father that she wanted to take some pictures of the scene. She invited him to accompany her, but he declined. At the time, Stacy was wearing an off-white windbreaker, along with a white jersey blouse, some riding pants, and a pair of flip-flops. As she walked off, her father reminded her to change into hiking boots before they set off. Stacy acknowledged the reminder, then continued off towards the older man perched up upon the rock. Once she finished taking pictures of the meadow, the older man informed Stacy of another beautiful view that he knew of, one down by a lake just a short distance away. Stacy was unfamiliar with the area, but the man offered to show her the way, and after getting to his feet, they began to walk down the lake. Their route down the hillside was in plain view of everyone at the cabins, and those that watched saw the pair slowly make their way downwards. But around halfway down, the older man stopped to take a short break, perching himself on a rock as he'd done just a few minutes previously. Stacy, on the other hand, was not feeling tired. She carried on down the trail, then disappeared from view behind a dense patch of trees. Minutes later, the old man followed, but when he reached the lake, Stacy was nowhere to be seen. He tottered around for a minute or two, looking around in confusion. He even called out for his young, camera-toting companion, yet there was no reply to be heard. The man assumed that Stacy had somehow returned via an alternate route and then made his way back to the cabins on the assumption that she'd be there. But she wasn't. Stacy Aris was gone. The older man, whose name is believed to have been Gerald Stewart, quickly informed Stacy's father that he was concerned for his daughter's well-being. George Aris was unconcerned at first and believed that his daughter would return in due course, with a camera full of photos and a sheepish look on her face. Yet, it appears Gerald persisted and professed his concern that Stacy was there one moment and gone the next. It wasn't like Stacy had ran off. He was old, but he wasn't completely infirm. To him, it was more like she'd simply walked out of sight and disappeared completely. Once George Aris understood the gravity of the situation, he contacted the local park service to request their assistance in the safe recovery of his daughter. 14-year-old Stacy was no shrinking violet. She had a lot of experience with the great outdoors, but at the same time she was still highly vulnerable to the many dangers of the American wilderness. After all, such a sudden disappearance had sinister implications. And with that in mind, the Park Service swiftly organized a massive search and rescue effort, one which involved just less than 150 full-time and volunteer personnel. The teams concentrated their efforts on an area of around 3 to 5 square miles, with their focal point being Sunrise Lakes, but only a single trace of her was ever recovered. Behind the dense patch of trees she walked behind before seemingly vanishing, search and rescue volunteers found the lens cap to Stacy's camera. There were no footprints, no drag marks, no signs of any struggle whatsoever. And according to Park Superintendent Robert Benavides, it was as if the girl had simply vanished into thin air. The implications of Stacy's disappearance became even more sinister when a spokesperson of Yosemite National Park met a reporter from the Fresno Bee. "What concerns us is that Stacy didn't change into her hiking boots before she set out for the lake. She was still wearing her slides," said Linda Abbott. "If she planned on walking far, she would have changed her footwear, and to us, this is the best indicator of foul play." Linda's answer came as a response to the Fresno Bee reporter's suggestion that Stacy had planned to run away, possibly owing to some kind of strife in either her personal life or at school. Yet this was something George Aris had always denied. He approved of his daughter's lifestyle, and just a few days prior to her disappearance, had invited Stacy's boyfriend into their home and even took a photograph of the young couple on the evening of their middle school prom. In George's opinion, there's no way Stacy would have had to sneak off in order to see her boyfriend. And what's more, coordinating such a meeting without the use of modern cell phones would have been next to impossible. The decision to stay the night at the Sunrise High Sierra Camp was an entirely spontaneous one, and the itinerary of the riding trip was made flexible owing to the wide age range of the participants. With no outside phone line, there's no way Stacy would have been able to coordinate any kind of secretive romantic meeting. And so, if Stacy didn't wander off to meet anyone, where did she go, and why? Many dismissed the idea that Stacy had simply gotten lost on her way to the lake, as the path between the Sunrise High Sierra Camp and the nearby body of water is relatively clear and easy to follow. But what if the lake wasn't Stacy's intended destination, and what if taking photographs was simply a cover for her doing something else? Many months following her disappearance, it emerged that Stacy had a very secret smoking habit, and might even have been carrying cigarettes and a lighter on the day of the horse ride. Naturally, she couldn't just light up in front of her father or the other riders, so she was forced to wait until an opportune moment to sneak away for a smoke. At first, it seemed that Stacy and the elderly Gerald Stewart were willing walking companions, but the reality is that Stacy had been trying to shake him off. She might have even suggested that Gerald take a short breather while she went on ahead to take her pictures. Then, once she was out of sight, she took a sharp turn off the trail and ran off into the woods to smoke her cigarette out of sight. Yet once she was off the trail, the style of terrain would have changed dramatically. According to one experienced climber who was familiar with the area in question, the forests surrounding Sunrise Lake are, and I quote, "heavily wooded, with a very short line of sight." If someone ran off the trail without thinking about what they were doing, the climber explained, then it would be incredibly easy to start heading the wrong way on the trail. And if she got to the wrong meadow, which all looked very similar, she could have walked an entire mile before realizing that she'd been going the wrong way. Someone craving nicotine, whilst being compelled by the fear of their father discovering their nasty new habit, could easily have ran off into the trees without paying attention to where they were going. Cigarette smoke travels, and the glow of lit tobacco can be seen from even further away, so it stands to reason that Stacy would have ran deep into the woods to put enough distance between her and old Gerald Stewart in order to smoke her cigarette undetected. In that area of the world, mid-July sunsets occurred around 8:30 p.m., meaning that if Stacy did indeed manage to get herself lost, it's reasonable to assume that she would have remained so as light began to fade. In her flimsy slide footwear, progress would have been painfully slow, and depending on her position, the onset of darkness would have increased the danger exponentially. If a person walked off trail in the darkness like that, they would be incredibly easy to fall into a crevice and never be found again, the aforementioned climber added. I can't stress how dangerous it would be to get lost in this area at night without a flashlight. After 12 days of continual search and rescue efforts, local authorities scaled back their work until the operation ceased entirely. Stacy's parents were assured that neither the police nor the Park Service had given up hope of finding her, but that under the right circumstances, it would behoove them to assume the worst. After a nationally syndicated appeal for information, there were reported sightings of Stacy from as far as Colorado and Nevada, but none proved fruitful to the investigation. "The tough part is not knowing," said her mother, Carol Aris. "You would have thought some trace of her would have shown up by now." And therein lies the reason why Stacy's disappearance has captured the imagination of so many people. There's always the chance that after walking deep into the woods, young Stacy came across a violent, predatory psychopath who clamped a hand over her mouth, dragged her into the forest, then did God knows what to her at some secret woodland hideout. Yosemite is a huge place, and perhaps Stacy's remains lie at the bottom of a derelict shaft at the old Sierra mining site, less than 3 miles away on Tioga Hill. But perhaps something else happened to her. Something that conventional science isn't quite ready to explain. According to Occam's razor, the philosophy by which the simplest explanation is always the most probable, the poorly outfitted Stacy fell down a steep incline and suffered sudden but fatal blunt force trauma. But if that was the case, where are her remains? Again, there's always the chance that her corpse was discovered and consumed by hungry scavenger animals. But if that was the case, why did the search team's tracker dogs fail to lead them to any remains? One article from the Fresno Bee stated that one of the dogs that took part in the search was a 2-year-old German Shepherd named Duke. One might assume that German Shepherds make perfect tracking dogs, and they do indeed possess a highly powerful sense of smell. But skip one paragraph down, and the same Fresno Bee article says this: "Unlike bloodhounds, who chase the scent of a particular person, German Shepherds will pick up on any human scent and hone in on the person emitting it like a missile to a target. The dogs are efficient, but not infallible. They need to be upwind and just a little lucky to find whoever they're looking for." Long story short, the dogs might have missed Stacy's body. But given the rugged nature of the terrain in question, she couldn't have gotten very far. The operational areas of some search and rescue missions have been upwards of 20 square miles, but an article from the Fresno Bee dated July 28th of 1981 states that the search for Stacy only occupied between 3 and 5 square miles. At the height of the search, the ground team was over 100 strong. There were several different teams of tracker dogs and 2 different helicopters logging a combined flight time of 40 hours over Sunrise Lakes. A team of specialist divers even trawled the 3 bodies of water in the hopes of uncovering human remains, but none of their attempts were successful. As one volunteer put it, it's like she disappeared into thin air. So when all the evidence points to such a bizarre ultimate explanation, is it really so unthinkable to entertain it? During the summer of 2015, Vernal Kuntz and his girlfriend Jessica Mitchell were living in Idaho Falls with their 2-year-old son, Dior. During early July, Vernal and his grandfather, Robert Walton, decided to head out on an impromptu camping trip to Timber Creek Campground in the Salmon Chalice National Forest. Vernal, Jessica, and little Dior packed up their things, loaded them into Robert's truck, and then were joined by one of the latter's fishing buddies, Isaac Reinwand, before they set off on the 2-hour drive to the National Forest. Aside from a quick stop at a convenience store along the way, Dior and his family made the journey in good time and arrived at the campground on the evening of July 9th, 2015. The group set up their tents, lit a campfire, ate some dinner, and then got an early night. The following morning, the group was relaxing around the campground when Vernal's girlfriend approached his grandfather to ask a favor. Jessica explained to Robert that she and her boyfriend needed to talk in private, then asked if he'd watch little Dior for the duration. Robert agreed before Jessica walked off with Vernal to have their private conversation. Around a half hour later, the couple returned, but to their horror, 2-year-old Dior was nowhere to be seen. Both Vernal and Jessica each contacted emergency services at approximately 2:30 p.m. They described Dior as wearing a camouflage jacket, blue pajama pants, and miniature cowboy boots. Jessica also reported that Dior's blanket, sippy cup, and toy monkey, three things that he never went anywhere without, had all been left behind at the campsite. Local sheriff's deputies quickly joined Vernal and his family up at Timber Creek, with a search party growing larger and larger as the day wore on. They scoured the area surrounding the campground, covering as much ground as possible while simultaneously trying to calm Dior's frantically terrified parents. Yet their efforts were in vain. Despite scores of family members, sheriff's deputies, and forest rangers swarming all over Timber Creek until dawn the next day, not a single trace of little Dior could be found. To some, it was as if the boy had simply vanished into thin air. An intense search and rescue effort continued for around 2 weeks before it was finally called off. Jessica Mitchell was despondent and, in the presence of one police officer, blamed Vernal's grandfather for Dior's disappearance. He'd been the one who'd supposed to have been watching the boy at the time of his disappearance, and if anything, they should be asking him where Dior went, not flying helicopters over a forest that a 2-year-old couldn't have walked a quarter mile in. However, when confronted with this assertion by police, Robert claimed to have no idea what Jessica was talking about. She hadn't approached him before leaving the campsite. She hadn't asked him to watch Dior. She'd simply walked off with Vernal to avoid a public argument, leaving the boy almost completely unattended. Isaac Reinwand, on the other hand, claimed to have been fishing in Timber Creek at the time of Dior vanishing, but mentioned that he'd spotted him wandering near a small stream around half an hour prior to his disappearance. As the investigation continued, all but one of the party gradually changed their stories. Dior's great-grandfather, Robert Walton, who'd said that he hadn't seen the boy prior to his disappearance, claimed that he too had spotted the boy wandering by the stream. Some then suggested that Dior could have fallen in and been swept away or drowned in complete silence as he failed to keep his head above the water. Yet both Robert and his friend Isaac claimed that this was impossible. If the stream had been deep enough to present a danger to a 2-year-old, there's no way they'd have allowed him to simply toddle along next to it. Jessica Mitchell also changed her story slightly, following the confrontation with Robert over his failure to watch Dior. She backed down almost completely, claiming the request hadn't been overt so much as implied. She also completely denied that she and Vernal had been arguing that day, and asserted their private conversation had been terse but amicable. Yet when local media outlets reached out to Lemhi County Sheriff Lynn Bowerman, he told a very different story, and it was the one that set the general public aflame with speculation. "Mom and Dad are being less than truthful," Sheriff Bowerman said. "We've interviewed them multiple times, and every time there are changes to parts of their story. The little things all change every time we speak with them." The revelation led some to posit a truly terrifying proposition, that Vernal Kuntz and Jessica Mitchell were involved in the disappearance of their own 2-year-old son. Finally, in January of 2016, the Lemhi County Sheriff's Office named Vernal and Jessica as their two prime suspects in the disappearance of little Dior. This followed a private investigation by renowned professional sleuth Philip Klein, who publicly announced that he too believed the boy's parents were somehow involved. Klein stated that not only were the parents' stories chillingly suspicious, but that Vernal had failed a total of 5 polygraph tests which questioned his sequence of events. Jessica underwent the exact same number of tests. She failed 4 of them. "In my 26 years, I've never heard of a person failing that bad," Klein said. "And personally, I think someone knows where the body is." Although the charges against Vernal and Jessica were eventually dropped, subsequent developments did not paint them in a favorable light. Not long before the charges were dropped, the couple were evicted from their home after failing to keep up with rental payments. When they moved out, Philip Klein asked the owner of the property for permission to search it, permission which was granted towards the end of 2016. Klein must have spent a great deal of time searching the home, as he was spotted entering and exiting the property for months. Then, in early 2017, he released an online statement detailing the conclusion of his findings. Firstly, Klein shocked his followers by declaring that, during a search of the couple's former home, he had recovered a child-sized camouflage jacket. One, which matched the description of the jacket Dior had supposedly been wearing at the time of his disappearance. Then secondly, Klein compounded said uproar by asserting that Dior was dead, and that while his parents might not have been the ones to kill him, they most certainly knew who did. On the other hand, Lemhi County Sheriff Lynn Bowerman had been much slower to condemn Vernal or Jessica, despite having once announced them as prime suspects. He claimed they only did so after a careful process of deduction, and the intense questioning they underwent served only to rule them out as suspects. Bowerman also claimed that he put no stock in the discovery of the camouflage jacket, saying that he wouldn't be surprised if a little boy like Dior owned 3 or 4 tiny camo jackets, seeing as his paternal role models were such avid outdoorsmen. The sheriff was also quick to add that with a case like Dior's, it would be foolhardy to rule out any plausible explanation, while agreeing that Robert Walton and his friend Isaac could not be completely ruled out as suspects. "I had personally placed the parents higher on my list of suspects," Sheriff Bowerman said, "but even then, I'm not 100% sure." Robert would pass away in 2019, having never learned the fate of his missing great-grandson. Isaac Reinwand took part in a series of media interviews in the years that followed, making repeated claims that he had nothing to do with Dior's disappearance. Vernal Kuntz and Jessica Mitchell separated in late 2016, not long after their eviction, and Mitchell had since remarried. Both have denied any direct or intentional involvement in their son's disappearance, and claim to share the belief that Dior is still alive somewhere, since his remains have never been recovered. Trina Clegg, Dior's maternal grandmother, echoed the sentiment, telling a local news outlet that, "We will do everything we can, until the day we all die, to find him." To this day, Dior's disappearance remains an ever-perplexing mystery. No arrests have ever been made, and no one has ever been charged related to the case. Yet the eye of suspicion remains firmly locked on Vernal and Jessica. But what if they were telling the truth? And what if the slight inconsistencies in their story are simply the manifestations of a feverish and all-consuming anxiety? After all, the only thing that would be more concerning than inconsistent accounts would be if every member of the party gave the same robotic recitation of the morning's events. Eyewitnesses can be frighteningly inconsistent, and parents are often the first to come under fire whenever an injury or mishap with their child goes unexplained. But such incidences of serious parent-on-child violence are extremely rare, and when they do occur, most occur inside the family home. It makes perfect sense that Dior's parents would organize a spur-of-the-moment camping trip if they had sinister intentions, and it wouldn't be the first time someone has used a last-minute trip into the woods to cover for a serious violent crime. But if they truly did plan on murdering their own son, why invite his grandfather, who by all accounts would have given his own life before allowing him to come to harm? And why allow Robert's friend to attend, risking a further witness to an unforgivable crime? Like Sheriff Bowerman said, it's foolhardy to rule just about anything out, and it is indeed possible that the four adults came together in some hideous conspiracy to murder a 2-year-old for no apparent gain. But to some, it's just as likely that something equally terrifying, but far more unexplainable, is to blame. The world is full of unexplained phenomena. Even subjects of considerable academic studies, such as the origins of life, the source of human consciousness, and the passage of time, remain shrouded in antediluvian shadow. Perhaps one day, scientists will be able to properly explain the placebo effect or the biological function of our nightly dreams. And perhaps one day, scientists will also be able to properly explain why some people just disappear. During the mid-1940s, the most powerful nations of the globe were engaged in a top-secret race to develop the world's first atomic weapon. In the United States, the research program was known as the Manhattan Project, and at one point its scientific director, the now infamous J. Robert Oppenheimer, was faced with a seemingly insurmountable problem with his theory. As he and some of the Western world's most talented physicists convened to solve it, one of them muttered, "If only Ettore were here, he'd crack this one in no time." When Oppenheimer were asked who Ettore was and why such a talented physicist wasn't right there with them, he was told that many years before, Ettore had gone missing under very mysterious circumstances, and that untold scientific progress had been lost with him. But just who was Ettore, and how did he disappear? Born in eastern Sicily on August 5th of 1906, Ettore Majorana grew up in a highly respected and highly wealthy Italian family. His father, Fabio Majorana, was a successful engineer who served as the director of the Catania Telephone Company and later as the Ministry of Communications General Inspector. As a result, the Majorana family moved around a lot during Ettore's childhood, meaning that he found it difficult to maintain steady and long-lasting friendships. He became a shy, thoughtful child who retreated into books, but by the time he started school, Ettore's parents noticed something incredible about him. At the tender age of just 7 years old, Ettore was able to multiply three-digit numbers and extract square and cube roots using nothing but mental arithmetic. When presented with an equation that he found difficult, the boy would hide under a table or walk to a corner and face the wall, then concentrate intently until he excitedly called out the answer. Then, when Fabio tried teaching his son to play chess, he found Ettore exceeded all expectations. It was quite clear to his mother and father that they had something of a boy wonder on their hands, and as a result, they made the difficult decision to send him to an elite Jesuit boarding school in Rome. In 1923, when Ettore was 17, he earned the prestigious equivalent of a regular high school diploma, and at first, it appeared as if though he'd followed in his father's engineering footsteps. Yet after 4 years of study, and whilst on the verge of gaining an engineering diploma at the University of Rome, he suddenly withdrew from the course. His peers and professors were stunned, but to Ettore, his decision made all the sense in the world. Engineering was a respectable, enjoyable subject, but another had captured his imagination. Pursuing a career maintaining essential public infrastructure would no doubt lead to fortune and prominence, but the study of physics was the key to unlocking technological wonders, the likes of which mankind had never even dreamed of. History has since vindicated Ettore. Atomic energy is perhaps humanity's best short-term solution to the green energy problem, whilst nuclear weapons have brought about a period of relative, albeit uneasy, peace among the nations of the globe. But, at the time, the study of particles was considered a somewhat frivolous pursuit. The late 1920s and early 1930s constituted something of a golden age for engineering, with the likes of the Empire State Building and the Golden Gate Bridge being constructed during this period. Many claimed that engineers were the architects of the current epoch, but what Ettore understood is that physicists would be the architects of the next one. On July 7th of 1929, Ettore submitted a thesis entitled On the Quantum Mechanics of Radioactive Nuclei. Following a careful analysis by university professors, it was accepted, given a grade of 110 out of 110, and awarded a distinction. 3 years later, during the late fall of 1932, Ettore obtained his university teaching diploma in theoretical physics. The examination board, which included pioneering Italian-American physicist Enrico Fermi, reported that Ettore possessed a complete mastery of theoretical physics. After receiving such a glowing review from Fermi himself, Ettore received a grant of 12,000 Italian lire in 1933 and was invited to Germany to work with another world-famous physicist, Werner Heisenberg. At the time, Heisenberg was based in the German city of Leipzig, which had become a place of pilgrimage for Europe's most talented theoretical physicists. So from January to June of 1933, the relatively boyish 27-year-old Ettore spent his days rubbing shoulders with his scientific idols. He talked unifying concepts with Friedrich Hund, discussed quantum mechanics with Rudolf Peierls. He even took a short trip to neighboring Denmark to attend lectures at the Copenhagen Institute. Knowing all that we do about young Ettore, his visit to Leipzig sounded like a dream come true. But upon his return to Rome in the autumn of 1933, Ettore seemed different. In the past, Ettore had devoted almost every waking moment to the study of theoretical physics, but following his return from Germany, he ceased his regular study patterns altogether. Instead of regularly publishing his findings and conclusions, Ettore began dedicating only sporadic periods of study to what appeared to be one singular issue. When asked if he was suffering from malady or melancholy, Ettore replied that he was perfectly healthy, but had suffered a terrible case of gastritis while traveling, one that doctors claimed was brought on by nervous exhaustion. What exactly brought about this nervous exhaustion was never revealed or discussed, but it didn't take long for his old study habits to return with a vengeance, as Ettore began working on a groundbreaking but staunchly secretive new project. It's hard to overstate the depth of Ettore's obsession with his mysterious new project, but just to illustrate, here's an example. When Marie Curie discovered a neutral particle that could enter matter and expel a proton, she assumed that particles must be a photon, since at the time, this was the only known variety of neutral particle. However, Ettore immediately recognized that in order to move something as heavy as the proton, the original particle would have to be a proton as well. When Enrico Fermi learned of Ettore's conclusion, he begged him to immediately submit it for publishing, but Ettore declined. He was far too busy working on a secretive new project and was unconcerned by the prospect of someone else taking the credit. Over the years that followed, Ettore remained extremely tight-lipped regarding the project he was working on. The only things we do know regarding his academic career from that period is that he started to branch out into a multitude of other fields. As well as his continual study of theoretical physics, Ettore began to casually read up on economics, politics, and philosophy, particularly the work of a man named Arthur Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer was interested in certain elements of parapsychology, a term which refers to things like extrasensory perception, telepathy, clairvoyance, and telekinesis. In his work On the Will and Nature, he explained his belief that human beings were influenced by an intangible and mysterious force, one that was tantamount to magic. Schopenhauer also claimed that, theoretically speaking, human beings have the power to physically transform themselves and simply lack the mental capacity or will, as he put it, to do so. Following the release of On the Will and Nature, many ridiculed Schopenhauer and accused him of believing himself a wizard. But the man himself dismissed the accusation and eschewed the word magic in favor of the term practical metaphysics. Many of Schopenhauer's peers saw the work as marking the end of his credibility. But more than 100 years after the book was first published, Ettore Majorana, quite possibly the most intelligent man on the face of the earth, took its claims very, very seriously. In January of 1938, Ettore began lectures on quantum theory at the University of Napoli. Over the course of the next 2 months, the university's payroll deposited Ettore's weekly wages into an account at the city's central bank. Yet over time, they noticed that he hadn't withdrawn a penny of it. Ettore was informed that he had a sizable lump sum awaiting him in the account, but claimed that he was well aware, and that his abstinence was entirely deliberate. Then on March 23rd of 1938, Ettore walked into the bank, cleared out his account, then purchased an overnight ticket onto a ferry bound for his native Sicily. Naturally, Ettore's disappearance caused a great deal of concern among his friends and colleagues. But just a few days later, The director of the Naples Physics Institute, Antonio Corelli, received what appeared to be a hastily written letter in the mail. "Dearest Corelli," it read, "I made a decision that has become unavoidable. There isn't a bit of selfishness in it, but I realize what trouble my sudden disappearance will cause you and the students. For this as well, I beg your forgiveness, but especially for betraying the trust and the sincere friendship and sympathy you gave me over the past few months. I ask you to remind me of all those I learned to know and appreciate in your institute, especially Shuiti. I will keep a fond memory of them, all at least until 11 p.m. tonight, possibly later too. Signed, Ettore Majorana." Signore Corelli was deeply perplexed by the note, and its wording caused him deep concern. Yet the very next day, he received yet another letter from Ettore. "Dearest Corelli," the second note read, "I hope you got my telegram and my letter at the same time. The C rejected me, and I'll be back tomorrow at the Hotel Bologna, traveling perhaps with this letter. However, I have the intention of giving up teaching. Don't think I'm like an Ibsen heroine, because the case is different. I'm at your disposal for further details. Signed, Ettore Majorana." Although the second letter appeared to be an attempt to reassure him, Antonio Corelli remained deeply worried for his dear colleague and immediately contacted the Majorana family to share his concerns. Ettore's brother Luciano immediately drove to Naples to personally investigate the disappearance. With the help of the local carabinieri, Ettore's brother discovered that he'd lied in a second letter to Antonio Corelli. Ettore had indeed boarded a ferry to Sicily on the night of March 25th, and had done so in the company of a professor from the University of Palermo. Luciano then enlisted the help of some relatives in his native Sicily, who in turn instructed the police to question the professor regarding Ettore's whereabouts. The professor claimed that he and Ettore had spent most of the 10-hour journey together before Ettore retired to his cabin for a short rest. When the ship docked at the port of Palermo just before dawn, the professor claimed he exchanged greetings with Ettore as they disembarked. Despite a little morning grogginess, Ettore seemed in good spirits and left the professor with no reason to believe that he was in any kind of distress or danger. Sicilian authorities conducted thorough searches of all the places Ettore might frequent or visit, but not a trace of the man was ever found, and not a single person ever claimed to have seen him. The search for Ettore dragged on for months, with increasingly large amounts of money offered in exchange for legitimate information, but frustratingly, the investigation failed to make any progress whatsoever. To some, it was as if Ettore had stepped off the ferry and then simply vanished into thin air. On December 6th of 1938, while his family was still hopeful of his safe return, the head of the investigation into Ettore's disappearance announced that the Italian authorities had found nothing suspicious concerning his sudden vanishing, and that they had simply abandoned his office without any justified reason. To Ettore's family, this constituted a not-so-subtle attempt to paint him in a negative light. Ettore had disappeared, justification had nothing to do with it, and he had a teaching job. He wasn't a military officer, so invoking the concepts of abandonment and cowardice not only made no sense, it was downright insulting. The Majorana family, as well as scores of Ettore's former colleagues, approached Italian dictator Benito Mussolini on a dozen different occasions to petition his help. Each time, Mussolini pledged to dedicate time and resources to the search for Ettore, but each time, his promises proved hollow. Less than 10 months later, Europe was engulfed in the flames of its second major conflict in 20 years, and while the mystery of Ettore's disappearance was overshadowed by the destruction of the German war machine, the man himself was never forgotten. In the years that followed, attempts to unravel the mystery behind Ettore's disappearance saw the emergence of several credible theories. The first, and perhaps one of the more plausible, is that following a lengthy period of depression, Ettore took his own life. Many allude to the opening line of his first letter to Antonio Corelli, in which Ettore stated, I have made a decision that has become unavoidable, and I realize what trouble my sudden disappearance will cause you and the students. While the letter may not suggest that he'd taken his life overtly, a handwritten note later found in Palermo Hotel room had commonly been attributed to Ettore. "I have only one wish," it read. "Do not wear black. If you must conform to custom, just wear some emblem of mourning, but not for more than 3 days. After that, remember me in your hearts, if you can, and forgive me." The reference to wearing black quite obviously alludes to the practice of wearing black clothing following the death of a loved one. But was Ettore telling his family not to wear black because he didn't deserve their grief, or was it because he wasn't actually dead? What's more, Ettore was a devout Catholic, meaning he would have considered taking his own life to be a mortal sin. Yet while he certainly wouldn't be the first or last religious person to take their own lives, it seems odd for a man like that to save up a vast sum of money before suddenly absconding with it. While it's not entirely uncommon for people such as this to become extraordinarily generous in the days before their final deed, there appears to be no record of any such gift-giving among Ettore's friends or colleagues. Yet perhaps the ultimate argument against the possibility of him taking his own life comes from a statement given by the Bishop of Trapani, which was serving in the Sicilian port of Catania at the time of Ettore's disappearance. Monsignor Riccieri claimed that shortly before he learned of his missing person's status, he spoke to Ettore, who complained that he was suffering, and I quote, "a mystical crisis." Riccieri claimed that Ettore had sworn never to take his own life, but when authorities asked the Monsignor for more information, he cited the sanctity of the confessional and refused to say any further. Another theory, which also hinges on Ettore experiencing a deep period of depression, involves him retiring to an isolated Sicilian monastery to train as a Benedictine monk. As we've already mentioned, Ettore remained a staunch Catholic throughout his life and married his faith with his awe of the law of physics. Deciphering the mysteries of the world around him was Ettore's God-given purpose, and in doing so, he became increasingly awestruck by the wonder of creation. The theory is given credence by the fact that in the days following Ettore's disappearance, a representative of the Naples-based Gesù Nuovo Church reported that someone matching Ettore's description showed up on their doorstep on the same night he supposedly vanished. The man appeared upset and asked the church to take him in before teaching him the ways of the priesthood. This representative was forced to inform the man that there was no long-term accommodation available, but that he could seek help elsewhere. The man then thanked him for his time and disappeared into the night. The representative of the Gesù Nuovo said that the man visited their church on the night of March 25th, the exact same day that Ettore wrote his first worrying letter to Antonio Corelli. It's reasonable to believe that he was in a state of distress at this time, and his deeply held faith meant a church may well have been one of Ettore's first ports of call in a crisis. But is it possible that following this nocturnal visit to Gesù Nuovo, he remained sheltered and sequestered in some Sicilian monastery for the rest of his natural life without ever being tempted to reach out to friends and family? It seems like an incredibly unlikely outcome, and perhaps the most vocal critics of this theory are those that say Ettore was either murdered or kidnapped by some of the most powerful and most dangerous countries on Earth. To begin our exploration of this theory, let's consider the opinion of Italian writer Leonardo Sciascia. Sciascia believed that sometime in the mid to late 1930s, Ettore Majorana had a kind of premonition. He foresaw an age of apocalyptic nuclear warfare, and how men just like himself would be its key facilitators. And so, rather than be forced to work on a new and terrifying form of weaponry by fascists, either German or Italian, Ettore opted to voluntarily disappear. This theory ties somewhat in with the monastery theory, as quite obviously one of the places Ettore could sequester himself would be some isolated island retreat. But there was also reported sightings of him at a hotel in the Argentine capital of Buenos Aires, Local detectives were dispatched to the hotel, but found the registration page missing from the hotel's registry book, as if someone had carefully and deliberately removed it. Some have suggested that this was the work of some powerful but shadowy intelligence agency, but Ettore's wife, Laura, believed her husband was responsible for covering his own tracks. If he decided to disappear, then he will disappear, she reportedly said. No one will be able to find him. He will be found when he wants to be found. But what if Ettore didn't escape those who might seek to enslave him and exploit his incredible intellect? This is where the murder-kidnap theory comes into play. Around 18 months after his disappearance, none other than Albert Einstein wrote a letter to the President of the United States warning that the Germans might be developing nuclear weapons. Einstein urged Franklin D. Roosevelt to stockpile uranium and begin work on their own atomic weapons. But where had this sudden inspiration come from? Had the Germans kidnapped Ettore after following him to Sicily, having learned of his talent for theoretical physics? Or, alternatively, did a nation's intelligence services have Ettore murdered, rather than risk his talents falling into enemy hands? Again, this theory seems somewhat unlikely, as any number of nations could have chosen to target any number of nuclear physicists, not to mention that each country had a healthy stockpile of its own capable scientists. But as Enrico Fermi himself said, Ettore's intelligence surpassed any he'd ever encountered. Fermi believed Ettore was up there with Isaac Newton and Galileo, that no one else in the world possessed his level of scientific understanding and creativity. So, if Ettore was leagues ahead of Fermi and Fermi himself was crucial in the production of the first atomic bomb, just what kind of military technology was Ettore Majorana capable of producing? As we mentioned at the beginning of this piece, Ettore spent his childhood in eastern Sicily and often visited the Nebrodi National Park, as well as the neighboring Etna National Park. If Ettore knew the land well enough, he could have easily hidden himself away among the heavily forested hillsides, just not forever. And this is where the final, most terrifying theory of all joins the game. Ettore was a remarkable physicist, but he was also a talented engineer. This means that not only was he capable of profound theoretical breakthroughs, but he was more than capable of designing and building devices which demonstrated these breakthroughs. What if, somehow, Ettore designed and constructed a device that would allow him to hide from those who wished to use his knowledge for evil? What if this device was the very thing his pursuers sought? Ettore had become obsessed with Schopenhauer's theory of practical metaphysics, which was little more than a fancy word for magic. But consider how many scientific breakthroughs would have once been considered the stuff of fiction. I'm not saying that Ettore built a Rick and Morty-style portal gun and then zapped himself off to some alternate universe. But 7 years before the creation of the world's most powerful method of murder, who's to say Ettore didn't invent the world's most powerful method of transportation? Maybe that's why his brother, Luciano, had his people walking around the parklands surrounding the city of Catania, long after his brother was declared dead. Ettore knew that he had something so powerful in his hands that it would be irresponsible to test it somewhere as densely populated as a town or city. And so, maybe Ettore went out into the wilderness with a device comparable in strength to the first atomic bomb, and simply made himself disappear. During his letter to Benito Mussolini, beseeching him to help find the errant Ettore, Enrico Fermi said the following of his missing colleague. I have no hesitation in saying that this is not a hyperbolic statement, but Ettore Majorana is the most deeply gifted and intellectually brilliant human being I have ever had the pleasure of meeting. Enrico Fermi invented the world's first nuclear reactor, and had spoken of Ettore like a god in the presence of J. Robert Oppenheimer. If that was the case, what did Ettore invent or discover? And more importantly, where did it take him? Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 7 p.m., And there are super fun live streams every Sunday and Wednesday nights, the nights before uploads. If you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks offered for the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, the rot consumes.